We are talking today with Gino Strada. He is co-founder of the organization Emergency and author of the book Green Parrots, A War Surgeon's Diary. Gino, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
If you could begin, tell me how is it that you came to create your organization Emergency?
Well, I've been working for several years from 88 till 93 with the International Committee of the Red Cross, the Geneva-based International Red Cross. And during those years, I was exposed to the reality of war and have been working in many countries and witnessed the fact that very little medical and surgical assistance was available for victims of war, who were the vast majority of civilians. So in 1993, we decided to set up a small organization, professional organization, to provide high-standard surgical care for the mine injuries and for the war injuries. And that's how Emergency started. I mean, we established Emergency in May 1994 in Italy, in Milan, with that specific purpose, to provide surgical assistance to the victims of war. We didn't expect at that time that Emergency would have grown that big or that quick. But it did, and now 11 years after, we can say that it was a great idea, actually, because we have been able to assist over 1.4 million people worldwide in these 10 years. So it has been a big experience and a big challenge as well.
And where are the places, the countries, where you have facilities?
Well, at the moment, we have about 10 surgical centers and rehabilitation centers in Afghanistan, where we have 3 hospitals, in Iraq, where we have 2 hospitals, a rehabilitation center, another hospital under construction at the moment, in Sudan, in Angola, in Cambodia, in Sierra Leone, and now we are going in a few weeks down to Chiapas and Nicaragua, see if we could set up hospitals also there. It's not only the problem of countries at war, it's also the problem of long-term consequences of war, like in Nicaragua. There's no war at the moment, but the level of poverty, which is a consequence of the civil war, is still very important.
And how do you go about choosing the places that you're going to place your facilities?
Well, basically, in certain countries it's obvious. I mean, like Afghanistan or Iraq. In other places, we go and do assess independently the needs. And then if we see that the needs are there and not covered, we start talking with all involved parties in case there is an ongoing conflict, and try to set up what our preconditions for operating are, which means basically we want to make sure that everybody will respect our facilities. No weapons can be introduced into our facilities. Everybody has to have access to our hospitals without discrimination, without political or ethnic or religious or gender discrimination. If we have enough guarantees that these preconditions will be met, then we go ahead and set up an operation.
And have you found that your people have been treated well by all those involved in these conflicts?
Yeah, in general, yes. Of course, we had problems here and then, but generally speaking, I would say we have been respected. We have been respected mostly because we made it clear to everybody that we are neutral. We do not take sides. I mean, we do not take the side of this group against this other. We try to do the same things for the population, regardless where the population lives. It's an example, in Afghanistan, before 2001, we had 2 surgical centers, one on either side of the front line. And we were doing the same for the population living under the Taliban's control or under the Northern Alliance control. And when you show your neutrality and you practice your neutrality, normally even warlords tend to respect you, or at least to let you work in peace, which is exactly what we want. We don't expect them to agree with us. Of course, we don't agree with them. But, our goal and objective is to be there and try to save as many lives as possible. And that is what counts, actually.
So back up a little bit and tell me, how is it that you got involved from your work prior to all the war conflicts? What drew you into that?
Yeah, that's an interesting story because, you know, I was before involved in a very high-tech level of surgery, you know, heart transplants, you know, lung transplantation, this kind of stuff. But I really wanted to know what my job as a surgeon would be like in a third world country. So it was just curious. And I ended up in a hospital in 1988 on the Pakistani-Afghani border. And at that time, there was very fierce fighting ongoing in the region of Kandahar in Afghanistan between the Mujahideen and the Soviet occupation forces. And so in this hospital, we could see basically Afghan war wounded, brought into the hospital sometimes 1-2 days later in horrible conditions, coming from the region of Kandahar. And that was my first exposure to war surgery, actually. And I realized then that, you know, for the civilian population in times of war, there's virtually no medical or surgical facility available. The few facilities are normally reserved for the militaries. The militaries can receive a decent treatment, unlike civilians. So that experience, you know, was very important for me. After the first mission I had there in Quetta, in Pakistan, close to the Afghan border, I decided to abandon, you know, cardiac surgery and transplant surgery and to concentrate on war surgery because it was very much needed. You know, if you are a surgeon, it's easy to say, okay, here are the needs, we can help, so let's do it.
So you opted to stay in that region then and continue doing surgery?
Well, I moved around a little bit in the sense that working with the International Red Cross, I spent time in Afghanistan, and then I was in Peru. At the time, there was a Shining Path and terrorist acts in Peru that affected very much the civilians. And then I went down to Ethiopia, and then in Cambodia, and then again back to Pakistan, then to Kabul. So I've been, you know, traveling a lot, always doing surgery for 5 years. And that has been a very important experience in my life.
And what prompted you to start thinking beyond the confines of what the Red Cross was doing?
Well, in fact, you know, after 92, the Red Cross had, you know, decreased dramatically their surgical activities. Basically, they changed policies. And therefore, instead of opening new hospitals, they started to close down the old hospitals. And I felt that was a wrong decision. Or anyhow, I'm not criticizing them. I'm just saying that that left a gap, basically, a black hole, you know, of many, many thousands of civilians injured who couldn't find any more proper surgical assistance. And on top of it, I was feeling a bit discomfortable to work in facilities very, very basic where, you know, major surgery could not be performed properly. And I thought together with friends that we should have gone for a much higher level of surgery. And that's basically one of the reasons why we decided to establish emergency in 1994.
So how did you go about actually bringing in the resources that you needed?
Well, that has been a surprise in the sense that emergency started, you know, in Italy basically simultaneously with a couple of events. The first one was the war in Rwanda in 1994. And 2 weeks after we established the organization, we left and we went down with a surgical team in Rwanda. And we, in fact, were able to reopen the hospital of the capital city, Kigali. At the same time, emergency was very much involved in the campaign to ban landmines. And that has been, you know, one of the reasons why emergency in a very short period of time became so popular in Italy. And popularity meant also solidarity in a sense that, you know, since we were, in fact, helping landmine victims, not just talking about mine victims, and we were doing surgery on landmine victims, people felt obliged to support us. And then we started to get, you know, not a lot of financial resources, but enough to run our projects. And then it grew and grew over and over. And last year, budget of emergency has been 17 million euros, which is roughly $21-22 million. which is not a big budget. I mean, we are a small size organization, but it's enough for us to run 10 surgical centers and to provide assistance to a lot of people.
And does most of your support come from Italy?
Yeah, at the moment, yes. I hope in the future it will change. I would say that in Italy, 70% of our money comes from individual donations. Very small size, actually. I think the average donation to emergency is about $40, which means we have hundreds of thousands of people who donate. The other 30% comes from foundations or municipalities, some banks. We don't accept money from governments who wage wars, and we don't accept money from companies who are weapon dealers, of course. We prefer to call for support from people, from ordinary citizens who understand the tragedy of a war and they want to do something about it. And all our money has come so far almost exclusively from Italy. I would say that probably no more than 2% has come from abroad. I hope it will change in the future.
So when did you start realizing that landmines were a problem?
Well, since I'm a bit slow, like most surgeons, it took me a little while. I remember the first time I saw a child injured by a green parrot. I mean, the Afghan nurse who was working together with me told me, "Oh, this is a green parrot. It's a toy mine." And I thought, okay, this is just, anti-Soviet propaganda. And then the second case came in 2 or 3 days later, and I said, "Oh, my God, what is this?" And then they showed me, a small fragment of this mine, and then I saw one. And then I started to realize, what the hell is this, There is somebody around who fabricate, mines that look like toys, more or less, or anyhow they look very attractive to children, and they are designed not to kill, just to maim. I mean, what this has to do with war? I mean, war is something that is, for me, is a monster, is the real cancer that affects the planet. But, even within the cancer, you have more or less horrifying things. This was one of the most horrifying. In my opinion, the idea of, mutilating children for profit is just terrible. I think, I cannot put it in my brain. So I had this exposure, basically, and the amount of casualties was so big that soon you realize that, every day you deal with one or two mine injuries. Every day. And it's like this in many, many countries. I mean, normally the public does not realize exactly the magnitude of the problem. But there are countries, such as Cambodia, for instance, where one Cambodian out of 215 is an amputee from a landmine. I mean, let's imagine what this would be in New York City, where 8 million people live. One out of 200 and something an amputee. I mean, New York City will change face. And that tragedy affects, in fact, nearly 70 countries in the world. And every month you can count on approximately 2,000 new victims worldwide because of these weapons. And these weapons, again, they don't recognize a peace treaty or a ceasefire. I mean, the landmine doesn't know that it has been banned. It will continue to go off. And this is a form of terrorism towards the civilian population, I think.
And Green Parrot, of course, is the title of your book. Which country and company made those particular landmines?
Well, the Green Parrots, in technical terms, is called PFM-1 and was a Russian-made anti-personnel mine scattered by helicopters over the Afghan villages. I mean, the mine is about the size of less than a pack of cigarettes. Very light, I think it's about 50 grams. So it moves with the water, with mud, with flood, waterproof, and stays there and maims for years. I think that several tens of thousands of landmines of this type have been scattered over the Afghan villages during the 10 years long occupation.
And then my understanding is when the U.S. attacked there, that we were dropping landmines that were often similar color and about the same size as the food packets that we were also dropping.
Well, yeah, they weren't exactly landmines. They were cluster bombs. But, you know, when they impact the ground and they don't explode, and it is estimated that somewhere between 15% and 20% of the cluster bombs do not explode, then when they are on the ground, they behave, in fact, like anti-personnel mines. And obviously, as you said, you know, I've seen these cylinders in Afghanistan. They were very, very attractive to children. You know, yellow cylinders with a white cotton parachute. I mean, which kid will not pick up this kind of object? So we have seen in Afghanistan and then in Iraq a lot of civilians, particularly a lot of children injured by this type of cluster bombs that were in fact landmines afterwards.
Yeah, I can remember myself as a child playing with little parachute toys.
Yeah, it's not surprising, you know. And this, you know, adds something sarcastic to the tragedy, actually. And I think that, you know, these weapons basically should be banned because they are weapons of mass destruction. They do destruct the life of thousands and thousands of civilians over the years. And they are persistent weapons. I mean, they don't expire. They don't have a target. So you use weapons, you don't even have an enemy. I mean, when you drop landmines, you are not aiming at the particular individual. You are just aiming at the population. You don't know who's going to step on that landmine, who's going to pick up that object. I mean, and in most cases, in our experience, and not only in our experience, is a data that is accepted by everybody, you know, that 93, 94, 95% of landmine victims are civilians.
So it would seem, using a term that the U.S. media likes to repeat a lot, that landmines are designed specifically to target collateral damage, collateral victims.
Yeah, well, I would refuse this terminology of collateral damages, you know. I don't like to use these terms where there are Class A and Class B citizens in the world, you know. Those who have the right to be mentioned, you know, the victims for whom we need, and quite rightly, I would say, to tell the story of their family, to show their pictures, to show the messages of the children, to bring flowers on the tombs. And then you have, you know, another huge amount of people, just collateral damages, 100,000 civilian collateral damages. You know, fortunately, no one has dared to call the 3,000 victims of the World Trade Center as collateral damages of the jihad. And it would have been a racist attitude to do that. So I don't like us to do the same. These people, they're not collateral damages. They're just people like us. I mean, they have families, they have names, they have, you know, feelings, love, stories, culture, interest. I mean, we don't believe that, but they like music too. So they're not collateral damages, they're just people.
When you got involved making that leap to doing war surgery, did you have any idea that you would be focusing and dealing with so many civilians?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It was something that, you know, I slowly realized. I think it took me at least 6 months. Then I started to ask myself, you know, but bloody hell, I mean, I'm not doing surgery on any combatants here. I don't see very, you know, faces like Rambos coming into the hospital. On the operating table, it was always, you know, children, women, people have nothing to do with the war. And then I started to document myself. I went to look into a couple of research institutes, the data they collected. And there are two very good ones in Oslo and in Stockholm. And they were documenting the fact that in modern conflicts, you know, at that time they were mainly internal conflicts, not international conflicts. I'm talking about 88, 89. I mean, they were documenting that the percentage of civilian victims was as high as 90%. So I started to look into the hospital where I was working. At that time I was in Kabul, and I went back to check the operating books of that hospital that had been opened in 1988. And I collected, you know, I checked the records of 12,000 patients, and 93% were civilians, which somehow confirmed those data. And after that, I was very, very much attentive to this problem. And I have to say that in every conflict I've been working in, with very few exceptions, 90% of the victims were civilians. There were some exceptions. In fact, I remember the war between Eritrea and Ethiopia in 2000, where I would say was the reverse. The vast majority were combatants, but that's because, you know, the area, which was a border area where they were fighting, had been evacuated. I mean, civilians had left months in advance. Obviously, everybody expected conflicts to happen there. But that was an exception. Otherwise, you know, civilians. So we should ask ourselves, actually, but who's fighting whom? If we civilians, at the end, are always those who pay the price.
Do you tend to find in Italy the media there, do they cover this fact of that it's primarily civilians that are the ones dying?
Oh, absolutely no. I mean, we had some opportunity to talk to the media, to go on TV show, and that had a big, major impact on the public opinion. For instance, that changed the opinion of many Italians, so that the campaign to ban landmines in Italy was very successful because of that. It was enough to be able to show to the public what landmines are, the effects they have, and who are the victims. And that, you know, created a great support and in the public opinion, to the point that when the law was presented to the Italian parliament for a total ban on landmines, there was not one member of parliament that voted against. They couldn't dare to do it because, you know, such was, you know, strong the reaction of the public. And I think that it was a good experience, you know, to see left-wing and right-wing politicians voting together against, you know, landmines. Because I'm convinced that, you know, you don't have to be left or right-wing oriented or Democrat or Republican to agree on the fact that this is a monstrosity and this horror should be stopped. So I think that, you know, media can be very powerful in this respect. Unfortunately, I don't know how it is in the United States, actually, but in Italy we have a strange media system, very strange, you know. Half of the media are privately owned by the Prime Minister of Italy, and the other half is publicly owned, if I can say that, by the same person. So basically, these are no media, are ways of disinforming people, not of informing people. And that's why I think that it would be very important for citizens to get to know what the reality of war is, what has become, in fact, because it hasn't always been like this. If we go back, you know, 100 years, the war was different. I mean, wars were fought by armies, basically. Of course, civilians were somehow affected. No, there was poverty in a country at war, that's for sure. But, you know, at the end of World War One, only 15% of the casualties were civilians. Today, in every conflict, the safest job is to be a combatant. And that is crazy. It means that war has changed, and it's changed because of certain very clear factors, you know, like, you know, carpet bombings of cities, use of weapons of mass destruction, genocide attempts. Think about the Holocaust, for instance. I mean, these factors change the history of humanity and change the history of modern warfare, actually. And the turning point was exactly World War II. After that, it has been, you know, a great bloodshed of civilians.
It seems to be paralleling our move towards weapons that get us farther and farther away from those victims, and the separation, I think, more of people from seeing the conflict, so that the media continues to, although I think Vietnam broke the mold on that, but the media reports less and less on those people who are being killed.
Well, that's true, you know, and today we are in a situation where in Iraq, for example, I mean, no independent reporters or media are there. Media are embedded. And embedded means that basically there's no media anymore. Could be the army who dishes out a bulletin and that's it. So basically the world citizens are absolutely not informed about what's going on in the world today. And that is a tragedy. It's a tragedy because, in fact, it shapes a bit the mind of the people, and it anesthetizes the brains, you know. And at the end, people not always are able to react.
Getting back to landmines, tell me what, obviously, Italy, it was in 1997 that they passed laws for the elimination of landmines.
Yeah.
What other countries are currently producing and or allowing the use of landmines?
There are no clear data about production because, you know, this kind of production is not very much publicized. But Italy was one of the top world producers, in fact, was always between the top three producers in the world. And the company that was producing these weapons in Italy was the Fiat company. I mean, don't buy a Fiat car, not just because they make landmines, they made landmines, but also because it's a very bad car. But, not only in Italy the campaign was successful, the Ottawa Treaty for a ban on landmines has been signed by 155 countries. Unfortunately, a few very important countries are missing, like Russia, United States, China, India, Pakistan. And, you know, these countries together, at least geographically, they are two-thirds of the planet. And this is very disturbing because, you know, would be very important that these countries also would join the Ottawa Treaty. Then production is a strange phenomenon because many major countries tend to subcontract the production, tend to subcontract overseas the production of components. So it's always difficult to track down who has actually fabricated that landmine. For instance, there are, you know, Iranian copies, perfect copies of the US-made Claymore fragmentation landmine. I don't know if this is on a license or not, the fact is that Today, the world is still left with some 100 million unexploded landmines, and it will take decades to clear them up. And unfortunately, those who are going to clear them up will be children and women mostly. One each, basically.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Gino Strada. He is co-founder of the organization Emergency and author of the book Green Parrots, A War Surgeon's Diary. What do you see as the best route to take in the elimination of landmines worldwide?
Well, for sure, in the field, mine clearance operations are very much needed. Although it's a long process, it's a very expensive process. I mean, if you think that the average cost of a landmine can be probably less than $10. But to eliminate a landmine would cost between $300 and $1,000 for each landmine. So for sure these countries polluted with landmines, which are among the poorest countries, cannot afford that. Most governments in these countries, they don't even want to clear landmines. And this is part of the problem in the field. Perfectly aware that, you know, mine clearance will not directly affect the problem in humanitarian terms. What I mean is that before you can clear up a significant proportion of landmines and therefore observe a decrease in the number of victims per year, it will take decades, regardless how much money spent, how good the mine clearance operations will be. But at least, you know, to have countries who understand the problem and the tragedy of the problem and therefore who sign a ban on landmines will help generations for the next century. And that is what is important, I mean, to prevent this pollution to continue in the planet.
Do you think maybe at some point in the future we might structure things where we would countries and or companies that produce landmines and place them in other countries or in their own country, there could be some type of reparation to pay for the removal of those landmines?
Well, I don't know, actually. I'm just a surgeon. I'm not a political analyst. But, you know, if I take Italy as an example, for instance, I mean, the Fiat company is not doing that well, actually, apart from the landmine business. But should they be obliged to pay money to, you know, assist, for instance, mine victims in the countries where their landmines have been creating victims, Fiat company will close tomorrow. Probably the same would apply to other countries as well. And we don't live in a world that, in my opinion, is very much interested in this, you know, in helping the victims. So we live in a world where most powerful countries tend to create victims and, as you said before, and just call them collateral damages and not interested anymore in their future, I mean.
You brought up assisting landmine victims, and I understand that one of the many things that emergency does is assist people after the surgery is over. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. It's not enough to do surgery. I mean, unfortunately, a significant proportion of my victims end up with some form of mutilation. They lose legs or limbs or sight. And, you know, since this happens also in poor countries or in countries of war, what are the chances of these people to find a job, for instance? Virtually zero. So we decided years ago to start with rehabilitation and social reintegration centers. We have a center, for instance, in Iraq, in Sulaymaniyah, where we produce 3 to 4 prostheses per day, both lower limbs and upper limbs. Patients go to the center, they stay there until the prosthetic fitting process is completed, and then we offer them the possibility to attend courses in vocational training workshops, and we teach them a job, carpentry, blacksmith, or tailor or leather workshops. Some of them make shoes. And eventually, after, you know, a 6-month course, it's quite a formal training course, actually. They have to pass an exam, they get a diploma. And then we put them together in small cooperatives that we help to set up these cooperatives. Cooperatives of 2, 3, 4 people, picking up, you know, disabled people living in the same village or nearby. And we set up their own small business and then monitor that the cooperative is capable to maintain not only these disabled people, but also their families. And at the moment, we have established 112 small business cooperatives in Iraq, and they are working very well. So this should be the end of the therapy, you know, when a mine victim or a war victim that comes to the emergency admission of one of our centers after a mine explosion ends up not as a disabled person, but as a support of his family. So basically, you have given back what was possible to give back, of course, artificial limbs, but, you know, still dignity of life, which is the most important thing.
In a lot of ways, it seems like the success so far of your organization is in some ways a sad statement and both a great example. A sad statement because, obviously, it demonstrates that there is this massive need out there that keeps growing from countries like ours here in the U.S., and yet it's inspiring because you offer this example that should be mirrored and supported and is a model for that countries should be getting behind.
Yeah, I have the same feeling, basically. You know, when I'm in our hospitals, I have this contradictory feelings. You know, you see patients with horrific injuries, the most horrific injuries you can imagine. I mean, me as a surgeon, I never seen anything like, you know, landmine victims, for instance, in terms of feeling disgusted by the type of injuries they have. But at the same time, you meet patients, you know, after 10 days, 15 days there in the garden when they have recovered from surgery, which is quite often major surgery. And you see them with joy. I mean, they are happy people. They laugh, they talk, they play. You know, children play. It's unbelievable. They don't cry in these hospitals. You know, when one of our kids falls down and scratches a knee, or is, you know, screaming and shouting for half an hour. I mean, these kids, they lose a hand or a leg, they don't cry. And after 10 days, they laugh. They seem happy. So I also had this contradictory feeling, you know, and I think our hospitals, despite the fact that they are a sad place for what they witness, in fact they're also, you know, joyful places in a way. And we try to make them nice also for that reason. I mean, in our surgical center in Kabul, in the garden, we have 200 different types of roses. And I think that's probably the best psychological support for the patients, I mean, to, particularly in these countries, you know, so that they find themselves in a friendly environment, which is exactly what a hospital should be, a place full of hospitality, not a place where they bill you every 5 minutes, basically.
So how do you bring in your staff and your medical people? Is that something that, let's say, listeners would be able to participate in if they had the qualifications?
Of course. Well, listeners would be able to participate in emergency even if they are not surgeons or nurses. I mean, emergency is not a typical non-governmental organization, as we call it. Is made by people. It's made by people who make these humanitarian projects possible. Just by using fantasy, I mean, is enough to decide to get involved. That then, you know, everybody can find his own little way to help. Of course, if somebody is a nurse or a doctor or whatever, not only can help from Italy or from the United States, they could also join us in the field. We would welcome U.S. personnel. We had already 3 surgeons, I think, that came to work with us. And I think they had a very good experience. We will welcome more. Also because, you know, it's important to have a direct exposure to the problem. And then maybe to come back and tell the stories and tell about what they've done, but also what they've seen. So I think that that would be a very good step forward. I mean, also for us, we are very much interested, also because we desperately need personnel for all our hospitals, very much interested to get U.S. citizens involved. So maybe somebody will be listening to us on the radio and say, oh, I sent my CV. You know, our website is www.emergencyusa.org. So it's easy. It's easy. I mean, when people decide to get involved, then they find their own way.
So obviously one of the bigger problems here is how do we get to the point where we make war obsolete and in the long run, I guess, make your organization obsolete as well. But
yeah, well, that's not only a problem in the United States, unfortunately. I think that too many governments consider war as a solution of something. You know, every time there's a new monster on the horizon, and that is what justifies war. My feeling is that Albert Einstein was right when he said the war cannot be humanized; it can only be abolished. And today, I'm convinced that the war citizens, they don't have, you know, 1 century in front of them to abolish war. It has to be done earlier, because the weapons of mass destruction are available to everybody, because the risk is so high. There is an incredibly high risk of an international nuclear conflict, and nobody speaks about it. Atomic scientists do, but war citizens are not informed. The risk is very high. We live in a very, very risky planet. And the only way out is to ban war. Till war will be available as a solution, obviously the one who is stronger and more powerful will always think that way. You know? Hey, guys, either you do like this or I bomb you on Wednesday. If war is left as an option, it will always be chosen. The only thing, you know, that could save the planet, I think, is to ban war and therefore to force human beings to start talking and discussing, and if they don't agree, talk again, until they find alternative means to solve the problems. You know, it takes 5 minutes to shoot each other, and then it takes 30 years to heal the scars. And if this is true in general, can you imagine when you have available, you know, weapons of mass destruction like nukes? This is why I'm convinced that the only option is there. War has to, I mean, we are in the third millennium, we call ourselves civilized. But, you know, have you ever heard of 100,000 foxes going to hunt 500,000 chickens? No. I mean, this is something unique to humans. I mean, in the rest of the animal kingdom, doesn't happen. You know, 100,000 against 500,000 is normally 1-to-1. In the third millennium, I think we should culturally evolve to understand that war is something that is not even barbarians. I mean, barbarians understood the tragedy of war. It's something that just should not be practiced, and there's no one justification today for using mass violence once again after what we have seen, particularly in Europe in World War II. There's no more justification for that.
So you have been in the thick of this now for a while. Do you think historically we are close to reaching that point where we can abolish war?
I don't know. I think historically we are close to the point where we have to choose. And if we don't make that choice, I don't see a bright future. You know, I think that basically the risk is to end the human experiment. And therefore, you know, if abolishing war 100 years ago was an option, I think it has become a necessity, and a very urgent necessity today. Due exactly to the fact that, you know, weapons very destructive are now available to everyone. And the risk is that this goes in a spiral movement, and at the end it goes spinning, and it goes completely out of control. You know, we never think about these things the day before. But we should learn also from the tragedy of 9/11. I mean, who could foresee that a month earlier? I mean, and it happened. And, you know, if we don't start thinking and acting about the risk of nuclear conflict, the risk is to discuss it the day after. There will be very few people to discuss it. So I think it's compulsory today to abolish war and to start that process. There will be, you know, for sure other means to solve problems. I don't see how killing each other can solve problems. It just kills. You know, it's the same logic that was applied after 9/11. Okay, 3,000 victims in New York City, which was a big tragedy. Okay, let's go bomb a country. 10,000 civilians killed in Afghanistan. So now the number of victims is zero? No, it's 13,000. So you just, you know, do not bring justice to anyone. You just increase the number of victims. And that's a spiral effect. And this is absolutely crazy, because it doesn't respect human rights. And the first human right is the right to stay alive. And that right applies to everybody. Cannot be, you know, that right only applies to first-class citizens and then the others. Collateral damages. Human rights, by definition, are either everybody's rights, or they're just, you know, privileges of those who are included in the rights, and automatically they are condemnation for those who are excluded.
Once again, can you tell us how people listening can donate and or support your organization, Emergency?
Well, I would say the first thing to do is to get in contact with us through our website, www.emergencyusa.org, and to get involved. It's not a matter of, you know, donating money. That helps, of course, but I would say that is a collateral good side effect. The most important thing is to get involved, to participate. We are now forming chapters of Emergency in U.S. cities. We have been touring in 21 cities in 5 weeks here in the States, and we always found a great support and interest in our work. And I think basically Emergency chapters have been forming in all these cities. So it's important to have people willing to participate, in talking to fellow citizens, you know, informing them about the reality of war, informing them about the tragedy of the victims of war, and inviting them to a practice of solidarity in making, you know, humanitarian projects possible to assist the victims, to save lives. This is, in my opinion, a practice of peace and solidarity which is fundamental. I don't think peace or human rights will ever come as a gift from any government. I think it's up to the world citizens to build them up slowly, slowly, day by day, getting more and more and more people involved. It won't happen overnight, but you know, it's important to know that it will happen one day if we act. And this is basically the message we are trying to pass, and I think that a lot of people are listening to us.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
We've just been speaking with Gino Strada. He is co-founder of the organization Emergency and author of the book Green Parrots, A War Surgeon's Diary.